This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents I've Got My Eyes on You, a novel. Written by Mary Higgins Clark. Read by January Lavoie.
For Elizabeth and Lauren, wishing the two of you a lifetime of happiness. 1. Jamie was in his room on the second floor of his mother's small Cape Cod house in Saddle River, New Jersey, when his life changed. For a while, he had been looking out the window to watch Carrie Dowling's backyard. She was having a party, and Jamie was mad because she hadn't invited him. When they were in high school together, she was always nice to him, even though he was in special classes. But Mom had told him that it was probably just a party only for Carrie's classmates who would be leaving for college next week. Jamie had graduated from high school 2 years ago and now had a good job stocking shelves in the local Acme supermarket. Jamie didn't tell Mom that if the kids at the party started swimming in Carrie's pool, he was going to go over and swim with them. He knew Mom would be mad at him if he did that. But Carrie always invited him to swim in her pool when she was swimming. He watched from the window of his room until all the kids went home, and Carrie was alone outside on the patio cleaning up. He watched the end of his video. He decided to go over and help her, even though he knew Mom would not want him to. He slipped downstairs where Mom was watching the 11 o'clock news and tiptoed behind the hedges that separated his small backyard from Carrie's big one. But then, he saw someone come into the yard from the woods. He grabbed something off a chair and came up behind Carrie, hit her on the head, and pushed her into the pool. Then he threw something away. "You're not supposed to hit people or push them in pools," Jamie thought. "The man should say he's sorry, or he might get a time out. Carrie's swimming, so I can go swimming with her," he told himself. The man didn't go swimming. He ran away from the yard and back into the woods. He didn't go in the house. He just ran away. Jamie hurried toward the pool. His foot kicked something that was on the ground. It was a golf club. He picked it up, carried it toward the pool, and put it on one of the chairs. He said,
"Carrie, it's Jamie. I'll go swimming with you now."
But she didn't answer him. He started to walk down the pool steps. The water looked dirty. He thought maybe somebody spilled something. But when he felt the water in his new sneakers, soaking his pants up to his knees, he stopped. Even though Carrie always said he could swim with her, he knew that Mom would be mad if he got his new sneakers wet. Carrie was floating in the water. He reached out, touched her shoulder, and said,
"Carrie, wake up."
But Carrie just floated farther away, to the deep end of the pool. So he went back home. The news was still on the television, so Mom didn't see him when he sneaked back upstairs and went to bed. He knew his sneakers, socks, and pants were wet, so he hid them on the floor of his closet.
"Maybe they'll dry before Mom finds them," he hoped.
As he was falling asleep, he wondered if Carrie was having fun swimming. 2. It was after midnight when Marge Chapman woke up and realized that she had fallen asleep while she was watching the news. She got up slowly, her arthritic knees creaking as she pulled herself up from her big, comfortable chair. Jamie had been born when she was 45, and that was when she started putting on weight.
"I need to lose 25 pounds," she thought to herself, "if only to give my knees a break."
She turned off the lights in the living room, then went upstairs to look into Jamie's room before she went to bed. His light was out, and she could hear his even breathing, so she knew he was asleep.
She hoped he hadn't been upset about not being invited to the party, but there was only so much she could do to protect him from disappointment. Three. At 10:45 on Sunday morning, Steve and Fran Dowling crossed the George Washington Bridge and headed to their home in Saddle River, New Jersey, in silence. Both were tired from their long day on Saturday. Friends from Wellesley, Massachusetts, had invited them to a 27-hole member-guest golf tournament. They had stayed overnight, and this morning had left early to pick up their 28-year-old daughter, Aline, at Kennedy Airport and drive her home. Except for brief visits, she had been living abroad for 3 years. After the joyous reunion at the airport, a jet-lagged Aline had climbed into the back seat of the SUV and fallen asleep. Suppressing a yawn, Fran sighed, "Getting up so early 2 days in a row reminds me of my age." Steve smiled. He was 3 months younger than his wife, so she hit all the birthday milestones, in this case 55, just before he did. "I wonder if Carrie will be up when we get home," Fran said, as much to herself as to her husband.
"I'm sure she'll be at the front door waiting to welcome her sister," Steve replied, a smile in his voice.
Fran had her cell phone to her ear and listened as her call again went to Carrie's voicemail.
"Our sleeping beauty is still in dreamland," she announced with a chuckle.
Steve laughed. He and Fran were both light sleepers. Their daughters were the opposite. 15 minutes later, they pulled into their driveway and woke up Aline. Still half asleep, she stumbled into the house after them.
"Dear God," Fran exclaimed as she looked around her usually tidy home.
Empty plastic glasses and beer cans were on the coffee table and all over the living room. She walked into the kitchen to find an empty vodka bottle in the sink next to empty pizza boxes. Completely awake now, Aline could tell her mother and father were upset and furious. She shared their feelings. 10 years older than her sister, she had an immediate sense that something was terribly wrong.
"If Carrie had a party, why didn't she have the brains to clean up afterward?" Aline asked herself. "Did she drink too much and pass out?"
Aline listened as her mother and father hurried upstairs calling Carrie's name. They came back immediately.
"Carrie isn't here," Fran said, her voice now filled with concern. "And wherever she went, she didn't take her phone. It's on the table. Where is she?"
Fran's face was becoming pale.
"Maybe she got sick and someone took her home, or..."
Steve interrupted her.
"Let's start calling her friends. Someone is bound to know where she is."
"The lacrosse team roster with phone numbers is in the kitchen drawer," Fran said, as she began hurrying down the hallway.
Carrie's closest friends were on the team.
"Please let her be asleep at Nancy or Sinead's house," Aline thought. "She must have been in really bad shape if she forgot to bring her cell phone with her. At least I can start to straighten up."
She went into the kitchen. Her mother was starting to dial as her father read her a phone number. Aline grabbed a large garbage bag from the cabinet. She decided to see if there was any junk on the back porch or the patio and pool area and headed there. What she saw on the porch startled her. A half-filled garbage bag on one of the chairs. When she glanced inside, she saw that it was stuffed with soiled paper plates, a pizza box, and plastic cups. Obviously, Carrie had started to clean up. But why would she have stopped? Uncertain about whether or not to tell her parents what she had found, or to just let them keep making calls, Aline went down the 4 steps to the patio and walked over to the pool. It had been open all summer, and she was looking forward to relaxing with Carrie in it before Carrie left for college, and she began her new job as a guidance counselor at Saddle River High School. The putter her parents would use to practice was lying across a chaise lounge on the pool deck. Aline leaned over to pick up the putter and looked down in horror. Her sister was lying at the bottom of the pool, fully dressed and absolutely motionless. 4. Jamie loved to sleep late.
He worked at the supermarket from 11 until 3 o'clock. Marge had his breakfast ready at 10 o'clock. When he was finished, she reminded him to go upstairs and brush his teeth. Jamie came back, gave her a wide smile, and waited for her to say, "Very nice," before he bolted out the door to go to "my job," as he proudly referred to it. It was a 20-minute walk to Acme. As she watched him head down the block, Marge was aware that something was nagging at the back of her mind. When she went upstairs to make his bed, she remembered what it was. Jamie was wearing his old scuffed sneakers, not the new ones she had bought for him last week. "What on earth made him do that?" she asked herself as she began to tidy up his room. "And where are the new sneakers?" She walked over to his bathroom. He had showered, and the towels and washcloth were in the hamper just where she had taught him to put them. But there was no sign of the new sneakers or the pants he had worn yesterday. "He wouldn't throw them away," she told herself as she went back to Jamie's room and looked around. It was with both relief and dismay that she picked up his tangled belongings where he had left them on the floor of his closet. The socks and sneakers were soaking wet. So was the lower half of his pants. Marge was still holding them when she heard a piercing scream from the backyard. She ran to the window to see Aline leaping into the pool and her parents rushing out from the house. She watched as Steve Dowling jumped into the pool next to Aline and came up carrying Kerry with Aline's steps behind him. Horrified, Marge watched as he laid Kerry down and started pounding on her chest, shouting, "Call an ambulance!" In a matter of minutes, police cars and an ambulance were racing up the driveway. Then Marge saw a policeman pull Steve away from Carrie as the crew from the ambulance knelt beside her. Marge turned away from the window when she saw the officer get back on his feet and start shaking his head. It took a long minute before she realized she was still holding Jamie's pants, socks, and sneakers. She knew without being told how they had gotten wet. Why would he have started to go down the steps to the pool and then come back out? And what are these stains? She had to throw the pants, socks, and sneakers in the washer and dryer immediately. Marge didn't know why every bone in her body was screaming at her to do that, but without understanding why, she understood that she was protecting Jamie. The wail of the police and ambulance sirens had drawn the neighbors out of their homes. The word spread quickly. Kerry Dowling drowned in her pool. Many of the neighbors, some with coffee cups in their hands, hurried to the back of Marge's yard where they could see what was happening. Marge's neighbors lived in the bigger houses surrounding her modest home. 30 years ago, she and Jack had bought their small Cape Cod on this curving, heavily treed property. Their neighbors had been like them, hard-working people in similar homes. Over the last 20 years, the neighborhood had gone upscale. One by one, the neighbors had sold their small homes to developers for double their value. Marge was the only one who had decided to stay. Now she was surrounded by more expensive homes, and the people who lived in them, doctors, lawyers, and Wall Street businessmen, were all well-to-do. They were all pleasant to her, but it wasn't like the old days when she and Jack had been good friends with their neighbors. Marge joined her neighbors and listened as some said they had heard the music from the party and seen a number of cars parked in the driveway and on the block. But they agreed that the kids who had gone to the party hadn't been very noisy and were all gone by 11 o'clock. Marge slipped away back to her house. "I can't talk to anyone now," she thought. "I need time to think," she said to herself. The clunk-clunk sound of Jamie's sneakers in the washing machine made her even more frantic. She left the house for the garage, then pushed the button to open the garage door and backed out of her driveway. Careful to avoid making eye contact with any of her neighbors, she pulled away from the crowd of people gathered in her backyard and the increasing number of police who were on the patio and in the yard behind the Dowling home. Five. When Steve pulled Carrie's body out of the water, he laid her on the ground, frantically tried to resuscitate her, and shouted to Aline to dial 911. He continued to try to force Carrie to breathe, stopping only when the first police car arrived and an officer pushed him aside and took over. Agonizing and praying, Steve, Fran, and Aline watched as the police officer knelt over Carrie, continuing to administer CPR. Less than a minute later, an ambulance came screeching up the driveway and paramedics jumped out. Steve, Fran, and Aline looked on as one of them knelt over Carrie to take over the CPR. Her lips were closed, and her slender arms extended away from her chest. Her lips were closed, and her slender arms extended away from her chest. The red cotton sundress was crumpled and soaking wet on her body. They stared down at Carrie, unbelieving. Her hair was still dripping down on her shoulders.
"It would be easier for all of you if you went inside," they were told by one of the police officers.
Silently, Aline and her parents walked toward the house. They went inside and huddled at the window. Working swiftly, the paramedics attached leads to Carrie's chest to transmit her vitals to the local emergency room at Valley Hospital. The attending physician quickly confirmed what everyone at the scene already believed.
Flatlined.
The medic who had taken over the CPR application noticed a trace amount of blood on Carrie's neck. Following his suspicion, he lifted her head and saw a gaping wound at the base of her skull. He showed it to the police officer in charge at the scene, who promptly called the prosecutor's office. Six. Homicide Detective Michael Wilson of the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office was on call that day. He was settled with the newspapers on a chaise lounge at his condominium complex's swimming pool in Washington Township. Just starting to doze, he was startled by the ring of his cell phone, but quickly became alert. He listened as he was given his next case. Teenage girl found dead in swimming pool at 123 Wormis Pines Road in Saddle River. Parents were away when she drowned. Local police report signs of a party at the property. Unexplained head trauma.
Saddle River borders Washington Township, he thought. I can drive there in 10 minutes.
He got up and started walking back to his unit, the feeling of chlorine on his skin.
The first thing I'll do is shower. I might be working for the next 2 hours, 12 hours, or 24-plus hours straight.
He grabbed a freshly laundered long-sleeved sports shirt and khakis from his closet, tossed them on the bed, and headed to the bathroom. 10 minutes later, he was out of the shower, dressed, and on his way to Saddle River. Wilson knew that at the time he was called, the prosecutor's office also would have dispatched a photographer and a medical examiner to the scene. They would arrive shortly after him. Saddle River, a borough of just over 3,000 residents, was one of the very wealthy communities in the United States. Despite being surrounded by densely populated suburbs, a bucolic atmosphere pervaded the town. Its minimum 2-acre zoning for homes and easy access to New York City made it a favorite of Wall Street titans and sports celebrities. Former President Richard Nixon owned a home there toward the end of his life. Mike knew that as recently as the 1950s, it had been a favorite site of local hunters. In the early days, small ranch houses were built. Almost all of these were later replaced by much larger, more expensive homes, including its share of McMansions. The Dowling home was a handsome, cream-colored colonial with light green shutters. A cop was on duty on the street in front of the house and had cleared an area for official parking. Mike chose a spot and walked across the lawn to the back of the house. Spotting a group of Saddle River police officers, he asked who had been the first to respond. Officer Jerome Weld, the front of his uniform still wet, stepped forward. Weld explained that he had arrived at the scene at 11:43 a.m. The family members had already pulled the body from the water. Although he was certain it was too late, he applied CPR. The victim was unresponsive. He and other officers had conducted a preliminary search of the property. Clearly, there had been a gathering at the home the previous evening. Neighbors confirmed that they'd heard music coming from the Dowling home and observed a large number of young people entering and exiting the house and walking to and from their cars. In total, some 20 to 25 vehicles had been parked on the street during the party. The officer continued,
I called your office after I observed the gash on the back of the victim's head. When searching the property, we found a golf club by the pool that appears to have hair and blood on it.
Mike walked over, bent down, and studied it carefully. As the cop had told him, there were several long, blood-stained hairs sticking to the putter head and drops of blood spattered on the shaft.
Bag it, Mike said, and we'll send it out for analysis.
As Mike was talking to the officer, the investigator from the medical examiner's office arrived. Sharon Reynolds had worked several homicide cases with Mike. He introduced her to Officer Weld, who briefly summarized what they had found at the scene. Reynolds knelt next to the body and began taking photographs. She slid the dress Carrie was wearing up to her neck to check for stab or other wounds, and then examined her legs. Finding no injuries, she rolled the body over and continued to snap pictures. Moving Carrie's hair to the side, she photographed the deep gash at the base of her skull. Seven. When Steve and Aline came back downstairs after changing their clothes, they joined Fran in the family room, which was still littered with plastic glasses and soiled paper plates. Officer Weld had instructed them not to clean up anything until the prosecutor's office arrived and had had an opportunity to examine both the outside property and the inside of the home. Steve's arm was around Fran. They were sitting together motionless on the couch. Then Fran's voice began to shake, and she exploded into high-pitched sobs. They huddled together in mutual shock and overwhelming grief.
How could she have fallen into the pool fully dressed? Fran wailed.
Steve said,
We know she was out on the patio cleaning up. Maybe she leaned over to get something that had fallen in the pool, and then she fell. It was probably late, and she may have been tired.
He did not share with Fran or Aline his private fear that Carrie might have had way too much to drink. Quietly tearful, Aline was thinking,
Poor Carrie. Poor baby.
She had been in frequent contact with Carrie in the 3 years she had been away. She could not fathom that she would never see or hear from her again. She couldn't believe that yet again she was forced to deal with the sudden death of someone she loved. Fran was quietly sobbing now. There was a chiming from the doorbell, then the unlocked front door was pushed open. It was Monsignor Del Preti, Father Frank, as he preferred to be called. The 66-year-old pastor of St. Gabriel's, their local parish, came in. Obviously someone had phoned him because he said at once,
Fran, Steve, Aline, I am so terribly sorry.
As they stood up, he clasped each of their hands in his and then pulled up a chair close to them. He said quietly,
I would like to say a prayer for Carrie.
He began,
Dear Lord, in this time of great sorrow.
When he'd finished it, Fran burst out,
How could God do this to us?
Father Frank took off his glasses, removed a smooth cloth from his pocket, and began to clean them as he spoke.
Fran, that is a question everyone asks after a tragedy. How can our all-loving and merciful God fail to protect us and those we love at the time when we most need him? I'll be honest with you. It's a question I struggle with myself. The best answer I've heard came in a sermon given by an elderly priest many years ago. He was traveling in the Middle East and was overwhelmed by the majesty of the Persian rugs he saw. Those gorgeous creations, so skillfully woven into such beautiful designs. One day he was in a shop where those rugs were on display. He walked behind one that was hanging on hooks from the ceiling. Looking at it from behind, he was shocked to behold a confusing array of threads that led nowhere.
Such beauty on one side, total disharmony on the other, but both part of the same plan. It was then that the message became clear to him. In this life, we see only the back side of the rug. We don't know how or why our unspeakable hardships are part of a beautiful design. That is why having faith is so important.
The silence that followed was broken by a knock on the back door. As Steve got up, there was the sound of footsteps coming down the hallway. A man in his early 30s with sandy hair and piercing brown eyes stood before them. He introduced himself by saying,
"My name is Detective Mike Wilson from the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office. I am so sorry for your loss. Would it be okay if I asked you a few questions? We need basic background information."
Father Frank got up and offered to stop back later. Fran and Steve, speaking almost in unison, asked him to stay. He nodded and sat down again.
"What is your daughter's age?" the detective asked.
It was Aline who answered.
"She was 18 in January. She just graduated from high school."
The questions were gentle and easy to answer. Steve and Fran confirmed that they were Carrie's parents and that Aline was her older sister.
"When was the last time you were in touch with your daughter in any way? Phone, text, email?"
They agreed it was about 5 o'clock the previous evening. Steve explained that they had stayed overnight with friends in Massachusetts and gotten up early this morning to pick up Aline at Kennedy Airport. She was coming back from London.
"Are you aware that a party was being held in your home last evening?"
Of course the answer was no.
"There is evidence that liquor was served at the party. Did your daughter drink alcohol or use drugs?"
Fran's no was indignant.
"She certainly did not use drugs," Steve said. "I'm sure she had an occasional beer or glass of wine with her friends." "We want to talk to her close friends. Can you give me their names?" "Most of her close friends were on the high school lacrosse team," Steve said. "The roster is in the kitchen. I can get it for you."
Then he added,
"Is there any particular reason you want to speak to them?" "Yes, there is. As far as we know, there were a lot of people in your home last night. We want to find out who they were and what went on at the party. Your daughter has a severe injury to the back of her head. We need to know what caused it." "Could she have fallen and hit her head?" "That is a possibility. It is also possible that Carrie was struck with an object. We'll know more after we receive the medical examiner's report."
"Someone deliberately hit her over the head," Aline thought. "They think she was murdered."
"There was a golf club on one of the chairs by the pool. There is evidence that it may have been used as a weapon."
It was Steve who asked quietly,
"What are you trying to tell us?" "Mr. and Mrs. Dowling," Wilson began, "we'll know more after we receive the results of the medical examination, but I am sorry to tell you, we are treating your daughter's death as suspicious and will investigate it accordingly."
Still trying to absorb what she was hearing, Aline said,
"I can't believe any of the kids she invited here last night would want to hurt her."
"I understand you feeling that way," Wilson said empathetically. "But we have to check out everything."
He paused.
"Another question. Did she have a boyfriend? Someone special?"
Fran spat out the answer.
"Yes, she did. His name is Alan Crowley. He was very possessive of Carrie, and he has a terrible temper. If anyone hurt my child, I'm sure he was the one."
Mike Wilson did not let his expression change.
"Could I see that list now? I also want to know who were her closest friends." "I can help you with that," Steve said quietly. "And one more thing. We did not find a cell phone in your daughter's clothing. Do you know where it is, and would it be okay if we take it?"
"Of course. It's on the dining room table," Fran said.
"I have a consent form in my car. I'll ask you to sign it to allow me to take and examine the phone."
The unlock code is 0112,
Aline said as her eyes filled with tears.
The month of her birthday and then of mine.
Aline pulled out her phone and began tapping on it.
Detective Wilson, yesterday morning I received a text from Carrie. It said, I have something very important to talk to you about when you get home.
Wilson leaned forward.
Do you have any idea what she was referring to?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. Carrie could be a little dramatic. I just assumed it was boyfriend or college related.
Aline, I might have to speak to you again as the investigation goes forward. Will you be returning to London?
She shook her head.
No, I'm home for good. In fact, I'm about to start a new job as a guidance counselor at Saddle River High School.
Mike paused, then said gently to all of them,
I know how awful this is for you.
I'm going to ask you to help me in a very important way. Don't share information with anyone about the wound on Carrie's head or our concern about the golf club. As we question others in the coming days and weeks, it is critical that as few details as possible be made public. The Dowlings and Father Frank all nodded in agreement.
I will talk to you again before I leave today. And please, don't clean up anything until the investigators go through it and we determine if we need to take anything with us.
8. After returning to the house to have the consent form signed for Carrie's cell phone and laptop, Detective Wilson spoke to the officers who were conducting a search of the Dowling home and property. From there, in his car, he tapped in the cell phone's unlock code and hit the text messages icon. The first four were brief notes from girls thanking Carrie for the good time they had at the party. One said she hoped Carrie would be able to patch things up with Alan, while another advised her to dump that jerk and hoped Carrie was okay after the fight. Mike jotted down the names of the four girls as party attendees he would interview. He then clicked on the text message trail from Alan. He skipped to the bottom of the chain so he could read the messages in the order they were sent. Alan at 10:30.
Hope you and Chris are enjoying yourselves. I'm at Nellie's. Felt like decking him. And you.
Carrie at 10:35.
Thanks for ruining my party. You made an ass of yourself. You don't own me. I'll talk to whoever I want. Do me a favor. Get out of my life.
Alan at 11:03.
Sorry I lost it. I want to see you now. Bad enough Chris will be after you when you're both at BC. You didn't have to start tonight.
Mike wondered if BC meant Boston College. Carrie at 11:10.
Don't come over. Tired. We'll finish cleaning backyard, then going to sleep. Talk tomorrow.
This is going to be a ground ball,
Mike thought, using detective parlance for a case that would be easily solved. Jealous boyfriend? She's ready to move on? He isn't? At least one of her girlfriends telling her to end it. Mike put down the phone. Using his dashboard computer, he accessed the Department of Motor Vehicles records. He typed in Alan Crowley, Saddle River. A moment later, Crowley's driver's license filled the screen. His next call was to the captain in charge of the homicide unit at the prosecutor's office. He gave a summary of what he had found at the Dowling home and Carrie's altercation with her boyfriend at the party.
Ordinarily, I'd want to talk to the kids who were at the party before interviewing the boyfriend, but I'm worried that will give him a chance to lawyer up. He lives here in Saddle River. I'm 5 minutes away. My gut tells me I should go have a chat with him right now and lock him into a statement.
You sure he's not a minor?
The captain asked.
His driver's license says he turned 18 last month.
There was a pause. Mike knew that he should not interrupt his boss when he was thinking. Mike also knew that although Crowley was legally an adult, judges tended to give defendants latitude if they had only just turned 18.
Okay, Mike. Call me after you talk to him.
The Crowley home was on heavily treed Twin Oaks Road. It was a very large, white, shingled house with dark green shutters.
Very impressive,
Mike thought. From what he could see of the beautifully landscaped front and side yards, it was easily more than 2 acres.
Big bucks here, he decided.
A riding mower was parked on the edge of the driveway. Mike rang the doorbell. There was no immediate answer. He waited for a full minute before he rang it again. Alan Crowley had been mowing the lawn and was hot. He had gone into the house for a bottle of water. He glanced at the cell phone he had left on the kitchen table and saw there were a number of voicemail messages, missed calls, and texts. Carrying his phone as he walked to the door, he only needed to read one text before the reality of the nightmare that was enveloping him sunk in. The doorbell rang again. Carrie was dead.
The rumor is she was murdered. The cops are talking to the neighbors and asking if they knew the names of the kids who had been at the party last night.
They're bound to find out he and Carrie had a fight. Terrified, he went to the door and opened it. The man at the door introduced himself while pointing to the badge on a chain around his neck.
I'm Detective Mike Wilson, Bergen County Prosecutor's Office, he said, his tone friendly. Are you Alan Crowley?
Yes.
From the expression on the young man's face, Wilson was sure that he had heard that Carrie was dead.
Are you aware of what happened to Carrie Dowling?
He asked.
You mean that Carrie is dead?
Yes.
Why are you here?
I'm going to find out what happened to Carrie. I'm starting by talking to everyone who was at the party last night. Would it be okay if we chat for a little while?
Yeah, I guess so. Do you want to come in?
Alan, let's take a ride down to my office in Hackensack. We can talk there with no interruptions. You don't have to go, but it will make things a lot easier. Come on, I'll drive. Oh, Alan, before we go, do you remember what you were wearing at the party last night?
Yeah.
Why? Just procedure.
Alan thought for a moment.
I'm better off cooperating than looking defensive. I've got nothing to worry about. I had on a Princeton t-shirt, shorts, and sandals.
Where are they?
They're in my room. Would you mind putting them in a bag and letting me keep them for a few days? Routine procedure. You don't have to, but we would really appreciate your cooperation.
Yeah, I guess so,
Alan said reluctantly.
I'll go with you,
Mike said amicably. Shorts, a t-shirt, and a pair of underwear were the items at the top of the hamper. Alan put them in a small gym bag. He grabbed his sandals and put them in as well. Holding his cell phone in one hand and the gym bag in the other, he woodenly followed the detective out to his car. Mike Wilson had no intention of interrogating Alan before they got to his office at the courthouse. He knew that the more he could put him at ease, the more Alan would say once the camera was recording.
When I was at the Dowling property, Alan, I noticed a putting green. The Dowlings must really be into golf. Do you play?
I've gone to driving ranges and played a few rounds. I play baseball in the spring and summer, so I really don't have much time for golf.
When you were at Carrie's party, was anybody using the putting green?
I saw some guys fooling around on it last night, but I didn't use it.
I noticed you wore a Princeton shirt to the party. Any significance in that?
Oh, yeah,
Alan said while staring out the car window.
The day I found out I was accepted, my mother went on the school website and bought Princeton logo stuff for me and tennis clothes for her and my father. They were really excited about my getting in.
That's a great accomplishment. Your parents and you should be very proud. Are you looking forward to college?
I'm looking forward to being on my own, Princeton or wherever.
Their conversation was interrupted when Mike's phone rang. After he answered, a voice came through the speaker.
Mike, we have a 93-year-old male who was found dead in his Fort Lee apartment by a neighbor. No sign of forced entry.
Mike hit a button on his cell phone that took the call off speaker. He put the phone to his ear and listened. Alan welcomed the interruption. He needed time to think. In his mind, he meticulously reviewed every minute of his activities. The fight with Carrie at the party was because Chris was hanging around her, saying that he'd help her get settled in at Boston College. The felt like decking you text he had sent her.
I went to Nellie's because I knew the guys would be there,
he thought.
Then I started to sober up. I wanted to make up, so I'll say I wanted to help her clean up. Carrie texted back that she was too tired to clean up, and I went back to her house anyhow.
His blood froze at the thought.
They think I killed Carrie. The detective will try to get me to admit it.
His mind scurried around for answers. He came up with only one.
The guys at Nellie's have to cover for me,
Alan thought.
If they'll say I was with them until 11:45, I'll be okay. I got home around midnight. Mom and Dad were home, and Mom yelled goodnight to me from their room. I drove fast. I made it home in less than 10 minutes. I wouldn't have had time to go to Carrie's on the other side of town and get home that fast. I'll tell the guys to say I was with them until they left Nellie's. They'll do it for me.
That reassurance calmed Alan. He fought to stay calm as he was led into an interrogation room. The first questions were easy ones. How long had he and Carrie been friends?
Carrie and I have been together for a year, I guess. Oh, sure, we have arguments. Sometimes Carrie starts them. She likes me to be jealous.
Did you have an argument at the party?
Yeah, but it was really nothing. This guy Chris has been trying to get between us. He was all over Carrie at the party.
Wilson said,
I'll bet that got you really mad.
It did at first, but I got over it. It's happened before, but we always end up okay. Like I said, Carrie likes to make me jealous.
As he answered the questions Wilson was asking, Alan thought,
this isn't nearly as bad as I thought it would be.
Alan, many people get angry when they're jealous. Do you?
Sometimes, but I get over it right away.
Okay. What time did you leave the party?
Around 10:30.
How long had you been at the party?
I got there about 7.
Ellen, it's important that you tell me. Did you have any drugs or alcohol before you got there or while you were at the party?
I never do drugs. There were no drugs at the party. I did have a couple of beers.
Did anybody leave the party with you?
No, I was by myself in my car.
Where did you go?
I drove 10 minutes to Nellie's in Waldwick and had a pizza with some friends who were already there.
Who were these friends?
Bobby Whalen, Rich Johnson, and Stan Pierce, friends of mine from the baseball team.
Had they also been at the party?
No.
Had you planned to meet them at Nellie's?
No, but I knew they were going to a movie and then to Nellie's. I was pretty sure they'd be there.
What time did you get to Nellie's?
About 10:40.
How long did you stay?
I ate and stayed with them for about an hour.
What did you do then?
I left and drove straight home.
Did your friends leave at the same time?
Yeah, we all walked out together.
What time did you get home?
About midnight, maybe a little before that.
Was anybody home?
Yeah, my mom and dad. They were watching TV in their bedroom. I yelled goodnight.
Did they hear you come in?
Yeah. My mom yelled goodnight back to me.
At any time after you left the party at 10:30, and before or after you went home, did you ever go back to Carrie's house?
No. Definitely not.
Did you call or text Carrie at any time after you left the party?
I didn't call her, but I sent her a text and she answered me.
Was it about the argument?
Yeah. We were both kind of teed off.
Wilson did not pursue this further because he had already seen the text messages on Carrie's phone. He also knew that he would get a court order for any other messages or calls Alan had made.
Alan, just a few more questions,
Mike asked.
You have a cell phone, right?
Sure I do.
You used your phone when you sent texts to Carrie last night, right?
Yeah, of course.
What's the number?
Alan reeled it off.
So, Alan, you went to the party at Carrie's house and then to Nellie's and then straight home. Did you have your cell phone with you that whole time?
Yeah, I did.
Alan, the Dowlings have a putting green in their backyard. Did you see anybody using it at the party?
Like I told you before, some of the guys were on the putting green.
Do you remember if you used it at any time last night?
I never went over to the practice green, no.
So you never touched the putter last night?
No.
Alan, it was warm last night. Did anyone go swimming in the pool?
No, not while I was there.
Did you go in the pool?
No.
Alan, while you're here, I have a request that will save us some time later. There are a lot of objects at Carrie's house that have fingerprints on them. I'd like to know whose fingerprints are on which objects. Would you consent to being fingerprinted before you leave? You don't have to, but it will be very helpful to us.
Fingerprinted,
Alan thought to himself.
They must believe I did it.
The interrogation room suddenly felt smaller. Was the door locked?
Why did I agree to come here?
Alan was trying desperately not to show his panic, but he was afraid to refuse.
I guess that would be okay, he said.
And finally, Alan, we'd like to take a swab of saliva from inside your cheek. That will give us your DNA. Any problem with that?
Okay.
Numbly, he followed Wilson into another room where his fingerprints were scanned and the swab taken.
Alan, I appreciate how cooperative you've been. I have one final request. Would you mind leaving your cell phone with me for a few days?
Thoroughly frightened, Alan pulled it from his pocket and placed it on the table.
Okay, but I want to go home now.
They did not exchange a word during the 20-minute ride back to Saddle River. Nine. The minute Wilson dropped him off, Alan rushed into his house. His parents had not yet returned from golf. He ran to the landline in the living room and paused for a moment as he groped for Rich's number. Rich answered on the first ring.
Rich, this is Alan. Where are Stan and Bobby?
They're here at the pool with me.
Listen, a detective had me go down to his office at the courthouse. He kept asking about my fight with Carrie. I told him that I stayed with you guys at Nellie's until we all left together. You gotta promise you'll back me up. Otherwise, they'll think I killed Carrie. You know I would never hurt her. You know that. Ask the other guys now.
They can hear you. I have it on speaker.
Rich, ask them. Ask them.
As he held the phone, Alan could hear his three friends say,
Sure I will.
We're with you.
Don't worry.
Thanks, guys. I knew I could count on you.
Alan hung up the phone and burst into sobs. After the call, Bobby, Rich, and Stan looked at one another. All three of them were reviewing exactly what happened last night. They still had a hard time believing that Carrie was dead. Like Alan, they would be leaving soon for college. They had gone to a movie and afterward went to Nellie's for pizza. They were there at 10:45 p.m. when Alan had stomped in. All they needed to do was look at his face to know he was angry. He pulled up a chair at the table where they were sitting and signaled to the waitress, pointing at the individual pizzas at the table and indicating he wanted a plain one. It was clear to the others that he had been drinking. Rich asked if he had taken an Uber to Nellie's. Alan's slurred response was,
No, I'm fine.
The bigger room by this time was mostly empty. The crowd in the bar area where they were sitting had gathered to watch the Yankees. The game against Boston was in extra innings. The shouts and clapping made the room noisy enough to prevent their conversation from being heard at neighboring tables. Stan was the first to speak.
Alan, it's pretty obvious you've been drinking a lot. This is a popular hangout for cops. The Waldwick police station is right around the corner.
Don't worry about me, Alan snarled. I got here okay. I'll get home okay.
What's eating you?
Bobby asked, annoyed at Alan's tone.
It's not even 11. How was Carrie's party? Is it over already?
It sucked,
Alan said.
I walked out. That jerk Chris Coble was hanging all over Carrie. I told him to leave, and Carrie started in on me.
She'll get over it,
Bobby said.
You two are always fighting and making up.
Not this time.
Right in front of me, Chris was telling her they should try to arrive at BC at the same time so he can help her move in. He's moving in on her, and didn't care if I heard him.
Before the other three could comment, Alan heard a ping from his cell phone signaling that he had received a text. He reached into his shirt, pulled out his phone, and quickly read a message. It was from Carrie. Using two fingers, he typed a response. The waitress came over with his steaming pizza, and Alan asked for a Coke. As he devoured the slices and sipped his drink, it was obvious he was calming down and sobering up. The other three sensed that the exchange of texts had toned down the argument. They started following the Yankee game more closely when each team hit 3-run home runs in the 12th inning. After 15 minutes, Alan pushed back his chair.
Carrie said everybody had to be out by 11 o'clock. It's 20 past. I'm going to swing by her house and straighten things out.
Fine,
Bobby said.
Good luck, Stan added.
Are you sure you're okay driving? Rich asked.
Why don't you stay and watch the game?
I'm fine,
Alan said, in a voice that made it clear the conversation was over. A minute later, the waitress came over with Alan's check. Not seeing him, she asked,
Is one of you taking care of this?
Give it to me,
Rich said.
I'll collect from him tomorrow, assuming he remembers he came here tonight.
20 minutes later, the Yankees scored the winning run, and they decided it was time to call it quits. They piled into Stan's car, and he dropped them off at their homes. 10. It was much too early to pick up Jamie at his job. Instead, Marge slipped into a pew at St. Gabriel's Church and began to pray. At 2:30, she drove to the Acme parking lot and managed to find a spot where she could see him the minute he left the store. She spent that half hour in continued prayer.
Dear merciful, blessed mother, please help the Dowlings find a way to cope with their tragedy. And please, don't let it be that Jamie had something to do with it. Jack, if only you were here to help us. He needs you.
It was a prayer she had made to her husband over the 5 years since he had his fatal heart attack.
Dear God, you know he would never hurt anyone. But if he thought he was just playing, and he's so strong, please.
An image of Jamie holding Carrie underwater haunted Marge's mind. Suppose Jamie saw her in the pool and started to go down the steps. Maybe when she was swimming near him, he reached down to grab her. They used to play a game. Who could stay underwater longer? Suppose he held her under until she was... Marge's agonized thinking was broken only by the sight of Jamie coming out of the store holding two heavy grocery bags in each hand. She watched as he followed an older woman to her car. Jamie waited while she used her key to pop open the trunk. He hoisted up the bulging plastic bags and placed them gently into her trunk.
He is so strong,
Marge thought with a shudder. Jamie closed the trunk and started across the parking lot. He walked over to a waiting limo and shook hands with his co-worker, Tony Carter, who was opening the door and stepping into the back seat. Marge heard Jamie yell, "Have fun!" as the SUV pulled away. A delighted smile came over his face when he saw her. Waving the way he always did, with his palm pushed forward and his fingers back, he walked over to the car, opened the door, and got in beside her.
"Mom, you came to pick me up,"
he announced, his voice triumphant. Marge leaned over and kissed her son as she smoothed back the sandy hair on his forehead. But Jamie's happy smile quickly evaporated, and his voice became very serious.
"Mom, are you mad at me?"
"Why would I be mad at you, Jamie?"
For a long moment, a troubled look came over his face. That moment gave Marge time to look at him and, as always, realize what a handsome young man he was. Jamie has Jack's blue eyes and even features, his 6-foot height and perfect posture. The only difference was that Jamie had been deprived of oxygen during a difficult birth, and it had damaged his brain. She could see that he was trying to remember why she might have been upset with him.
"My sneakers and socks and jeans got wet," he said haltingly. "I'm sorry, okay?"
"How did they get wet, Jamie?" Marge asked, trying to sound matter-of-fact as she waited before turning the key to start the car. Jamie's eyes were pleading.
"Don't be mad at me, Mom."
"Oh, Jamie," Marge said quickly, "I'm not mad at you. But I just need for you to tell me what happened when you went over to Carrie's pool."
"Carrie was swimming," Jamie said while looking down.
"She was fully dressed," Marge thought. "I saw her when Steve carried her out of the pool."
"Did you see her swimming in the pool?"
"Yes, she went swimming," he said, not making eye contact with his mother.
"She may have been still alive when he saw her," Marge thought to herself.
"Jamie, did you ask Carrie if you could go swimming with her?"
"Yes, I did."
"What did she say to you?"
Jamie looked straight ahead, trying to reconstruct in his mind a picture of the previous evening.
"She said, 'Jamie, you can always go swimming with me.' I said, 'Thank you, Carrie. You're very nice.'"
Marge sighed inwardly. Time was always a hazy concept for Jamie. A memory of a place they visited a week ago would intertwine with his recollections of visiting that same place years earlier. Did this conversation with Carrie take place last night, or on one of the many previous times she had invited him to swim with her?
"Jamie, why did you go swimming with your pants and sneakers on?"
"I'm sorry, Mom. I won't do it again. I promise, okay?"
Jamie said, his voice growing louder and aggressive.
"Jamie, did you and Carrie play any games in the pool?"
"Carrie went under the water for a long time. I said, 'Carrie, wake up. It's Jamie.'"
"Did you help Carrie in the water?"
"I always help Carrie. I'm her friend."
"When you were playing a game, did you hold Carrie under the water?"
"I said I was sorry, Mom, okay?"
Jamie said as he started to tear up.
"I want to go now."
"It's all right, Jamie,"
Marge said, as it was obvious that Jamie was beginning to shut down. But she had to figure out a way to protect him.
"Jamie,"
she said, trying to make her voice sound cheerful,
"can you keep a secret?"
"I like secrets," Jamie said. "Like birthday presents."
"That's right. Like when we buy somebody a birthday present, we keep it a secret," Marge said. "But this secret will be about your going swimming with Carrie last night. Can that be a secret for only you and me?"
While using his finger to make a big X on his chest, Jamie said,
"Cross my heart and hope to die,"
as he smiled widely. Marge sighed. That would have to do for now.
"Do you want to come home with me, Jamie?"
"Can I watch practice?"
Marge knew he meant the football, soccer, or whatever team was on the field at the high school.
"Yes, you can. I'll drop you off. Be sure to come straight home afterwards."
"I will, Mom. And I won't tell anybody I was in the pool."
As if he was trying to change the subject, Jamie said,
"Tony Carter and his dad are going on a fishing trip."
"I hope they catch nothing but colds," Marge thought.
She had heard that Carl Carter had told people that the only problem with Jamie was that he didn't have his head screwed on tight. It was a remark that Marge neither forgave nor forgot.
"That's nice," she managed to say.